Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Right, friends. So on this Uposatha evening, in conversations and when we put out the question of what topic should we cover for the day long, something that was coming up was upekkha, equanimity. And this is something we've covered in the past in various Uposatha reflections. I think we might have done a day long on it, or maybe not. If so, it was a while back, but it's something that comes up a lot. So I thought to spend a little time this evening reflecting on equanimity and its place in our practice and how we might go about developing it and when to develop it. And so that's probably the first thing to maybe question for ourselves is where, when we do feel an interest in equanimity, where is it coming from? So equanimity has this interesting double existence in the Pali Canon and in our practice. On the one side, it is a factor of enlightenment, a bodhanga. And in that way, it's a stage of development, and it's the seventh and final in the list of the factors of enlightenment. In this way, sometimes in our practice, what we find is there's a natural progression towards equanimity, equipoise, balance, and stability of mind. And we get there through developing stuff that is more active, more involved, more energetic. We go through mindfulness, investigation of states, energy, joy. And then we're getting to tranquility, samadhi, and finally equanimity, this really grounded equipoise. And when we get that experience of the enlightenment factor of equanimity in our practice, it's almost like we're discovering. We've been doing things and we reach a point where we realize we don't have to do anything more, where the mind is where we wanted it to get to. And then we get to abide in that sense of stability. But the other existence of equanimity is that of the Brahma-vihara, the divine abiding of equanimity. And this is more, a bit more what I thought to talk on this evening, because this is the one that we can actually cultivate intentionally and develop as a sort of landing place for the mind, as a sort of abiding place for the mind. And so that definition of Brahma Vihara is actually really good for us to try to narrow down our idea of what this abiding actually is. What does equanimity feel like? What does it involve? And the Brahma Viharas, whether or not we have a lot of faith in the existence of devas and brahmas and celestial beings. A fundamental component of developing right view, mundane right view, even the right view that allows us to practice and get better, is the understanding that the mind can exist without a body. There are mind-made beings. And maybe we've experienced this in our practice. We've gotten to a place where it feels like the body just fades away and disappears, but we realize we're still conscious, we're still aware, and we're like, oh, there's just mind. This is amazing. This is wonderful. This is so neat. And then the body comes back later, and we're like, oh, what was that? Huh, that was interesting. But our experience of the world has changed from that point on. We know what's possible. If we haven't had that experience, maybe we have faith in those, wise and practiced individuals who tell us, yeah, this is possible. This is something that can happen for the mind. You can get to a place where the body falls away and you realize the mind doesn't need form. to exist, for there to be consciousness. This is useful for understanding equanimity, because the Brahma Viharas are describing a mental experience, a mental standpoint, which is very interesting. And I think a good reflection to start out with is understanding that the relationship we develop with the other, even the other Brahma Viharas, metta, karuna, mudita, goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, these are all mental standpoints. Often when we cultivate them, we think of an object, right? We think of somebody who is a benefactor or really kind to us, and it brings up this bright, warm, full feeling of happiness and friendliness in our heart. And we might even be encouraged to let our mind settle on that feeling. But if we pay attention, and as we start to develop, we realize that that feeling that we feel in the heart is just the mind relating this sense of friendliness towards the form of our heart center. And that same sense of friendliness we should experience when we think about our benefactor, when we think about our cat, when we think about the person who lives down the road, when we think about our parents, when we think about a person who, rang up our things at the grocery store. Our relationship to each of these objects is the same: friendliness, goodwill. Yeah? And this is the abiding of a mind-made being. Because they don't have one form, every time they relate to a form, it has a particular emotional tone. Whereas, because we have bodies, we tend to feel our relationship to the body change over time. It feels good, it feels bad, it feels neutral, it feels bad again. That's what having one form is like. But if we were in a mind-made existence, then our emotional relationship to objects, to forms, would be what? Well, it would be one of these Brahma Viharas, right? We would feel friendliness, or we'd feel compassion, or we'd feel joy, or we'd feel equanimity. And so thinking about equanimity and where we might land is imagining a state of mind where no matter what object we present to the mind, we feel a sense of balance, equipoise, and acceptance. Yeah, and this is the abiding place of equanimity. Now, that's the Vihara part of Brahma Vihara. The Brahma part is imagining that the stability, the incredible groundedness that comes when we allow the mind to get to this place where our relationship to every single object is the same emotionally. And that is the existence of the Brahmas in the various realms. The Brahma gods have one default relationship to everything that they become conscious of. They don't flip between emotions, yeah? And their whole existence is based on a very strong particular emotion. Some Brahma gods have lots of metta. And their entire lifetime is just every time they think about something, they got this bright, friendly relationship to it. And then there are Brahma gods who are full of compassion. And so every time they are conscious of something, they may it be free of suffering. They want to wrap it up and protect it. And that's their whole relationship to everything in the cosmos. And it has all of these various things that go. So what would be the experience of a Brahma god whose relationship to everything would be equanimity? And in the suttas, we get a thought, a sort of verbalization of what that relationship is like. And that thought is, all beings are the owners of their karma. heirs to their karma, born of their karma, related to their karma, abide supported by their karma. Whatever karma they shall do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heirs. And that every time they relate to an object, a being who is in this abiding of equanimity will have the experience of, okay, everything is as it should be. The world is orderly. The world is moving according to causality. This is their relationship to the world, which is very interesting. And in the Theravada especially, there is this sense of equanimity as a progression. Some of that you'll go through the other Brahmaviharas and then get to equanimity as your sort of final PhD level, development in the Brahmaviharas. And some of this comes from the Bhojanga, the enlightenment factors, whereas equanimity is what you develop towards. But some of this also comes from the kind of letting go and wisening of the mind that has to take place for us to be able to relate to all objects as they belong. They're in the right place. They're operating according to governing principles that make sense. This sense of balance and orderliness, it's very different than the other Brahmaviharas. With metta, it's bubbly, it's happy, it's friendly, it wants to relate to things and break down barriers, and it just feels good. And often it inspires us to do acts of good that bring more metta into the world. And compassion, we want beings to be free of suffering. And often if we see any way that we can help that come about, we extend ourselves to help that being. Mudita, there's this joy in others having good experiences, yeah? And all of these three Brahmaviharas and all of these three emotions, there is this sense of, may this being be good. May this being be well. May this being be happy. Whereas once we get to equanimity, there is this really abiding, steady sense of, they're good. That being is good. That being, everything is happening as it should. That being is receiving exactly the results that they should expect. Nothing is happening to them that shouldn't happen to them. They are getting all of the good results for all of the good things that they've done. And they're getting the consequences of all of the bad things that they've done. And importantly, there is a sense that that is for their benefit as well. Yeah, that will help them learn and grow. So it's not a disaster in the overall scheme. Yeah, it's just a temporary ouch that, leads to you getting better. And this is equanimity, yeah? It's this wonderful abiding where not anything really needs to be done. And so when we ask another question, like, why would I want to cultivate this? I think it's useful to ask this question. Why am I interested in equanimity? There are times when equanimity is maybe not the thing we should be inclining towards. Rather, we should relax and let it develop on its own through the progression of developing the factors of enlightenment. And that's if we're surrounded by a lot of annoying people, yeah? And we'd really just rather be calm and grounded and not have to deal with them. In that case, metta might be a better answer. Yeah, or we feel really overwhelmed by the world and we're like, oh, wow, it's just so much going on. And this is going. And, we think it would be I want a samadhi. I want to go into the jhanas and none of this to bother me. Well, actually, in that case, equanimity is probably not what we should be focused on. We should probably be developing compassion, for ourselves and for the beings around us. And this would bring up a more natural stability and energy and brightness to the mind. Yeah. Because it would reflect the objects that our mind is being presented and what's really getting to us. Yeah. The times when we might find that we actually have a really good reason to develop equanimity are probably those times where we feel a sense of okayness with our surroundings, with the people who are around. We're on good terms with them. We don't think about them much, but when we do, we're okay with them. We're not overwhelmed by the world, and the people around us are not overwhelmed with the world. They're good, they're comfortable, life is getting on. And also, we feel a sense of, well, this sort of wise, we say samvega, or just world weariness, where we don't need anything right now. We're content, yeah, we're satisfied. This would be a great time to say, oh, I wonder if I could abide in equanimity at this time. And then this thought of equanimity, all beings are the owners of their karma, heirs to their karma, born of the karma. This is the sort of thought we can start to bring up to incline the mind. Now, how are we inclining it? Well, we're trying to get it to land in a state that will be independent of all the objects that are presented to the mind. I don't know if I said that in a way that makes sense, but we want an abiding for the mind, an abiding that will apply to anything that comes up. And we want to get really good and settled into that abiding. And then we would find that, yeah, anger, ill will, envy, grievances, any sort of aggression we might have, all of that is not possible in that state of mind. Furthermore, any sense of being overwhelmed, any sense of being distracted would not be possible in that kind of mind state. We would have this pervasiveness of mind. And this is how the Buddha describes this abiding of mind. It's not that we have a warm, fuzzy feeling in our heart, but rather that our mind is pervading a space, that consciousness pervades a space, and that whatever is in that space, we have that same emotional tone towards those objects, towards everything there. Yeah. We might also be able to help move ourselves in this direction by thinking of something the Buddha calls the vicissitudes or the worldly currents. And I caution you in looking this up, I realize there are different lists. So the Northern school, China, Japan, Korea, they change the list slightly. And it's not always obvious which list you're reading. So the list I read in one sutta, given by the Buddha is, let's see, I want to make sure I don't, because my mind has been jumbled about it ever since I realized there's multiple lists. There's gain and loss, there's fame and disrepute, there's pleasure and pain, and there is praise and blame. And these eight worldly winds are pairs. Yeah, there's four pairs. And they kind of describe the mind being pulled one way or the other by circumstances. This happens and we feel, oh, this is good. This happens and we feel, oh, this is bad. And this is the mind with form, the mind basically being in the world and having to decide its relationship to things. There's a real subject-object experience here. And equanimity is a great abiding place to feel what it is like to not be in the world, to not have that kind of push and pull of circumstances. An example of somebody who might embody this, and I've told this story, we've gone over it, but there's this story of the Zen farmer, right? And it's this sort of farmer who, whether a good thing or a bad thing happens, he has the same response. And his horse runs away and the neighbor comes to him, and the neighbor's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry, your horse ran away." And the farmer's like, "Well, who can say what's good or bad?" And the next day the horse comes back, but it brings other wild horses with it. And the neighbor comes and is like, "Oh, what a windfall. This is great. This is fantastic." And the farmer says, "Well, who can say what's good or bad?" And the story goes on through a lot of increasingly improbable circumstances around this farmer and his family and the horses and all of these things. And it's just this example of what if every response was, "Well, who can say what's good or bad? These things seem to be happening by causes and conditions. This is orderly, this is natural, this is how things are supposed to be." And that is upekkha, that is equanimity. Yeah, the sense of things are as they should be. And can we get to a place where that is our response? Where something good happens and we're like, "Oh, that's a good thing." But it doesn't shake the mind. We don't feel like an urge to move towards it. Or something bad happens and we're like, "Oh, that's a bad thing." But we don't feel a sense of recoiling. We're like, "Well, yeah, this happened. There's causes and conditions. We've put them in place. Here they are." This sense of stability we find particularly useful. I don't know, as a from personal standpoint, as a monastic, we work with equanimity a lot because we live in a community, and it's a community sort of a little unlike a family unit. In a family unit, you've got like bonds to the people around you, and you've got a shared experience. But a monastic community, we're all different people from all different places. And we've got all different ideas about what's right and wrong and good and bad. And we're drawn together by our shared interest in the Dhamma and in practice, right? That's Sangha, right? And specifically, that's monastic Sangha. And what happens when you get into this sort of mixing pot of ideas is a lot of things come up where things are going to be done based on group consensus, in a way other than you would do them. And when this is the case, and if you can't relate to that, I maybe think of your job. Yeah, so in a workplace, there's a boss telling you what to do, but there's also your coworkers and you who are doing it. Right? And so you have this experience of it doesn't really, the boss will say one thing, but since you're the ones who are doing it, you kind of, how you do it will be how it gets done. And so the end result of any project is going to be the mixing of what the intent was and what was possible. And you meet in the middle somewhere, and it's like, "Okay, well, this is what we produced. This is the service we provided. This is the product." Yeah. And it's usually a little different than what the boss said. And it's a little different than what you would have done if you were just left to your own devices. But it meets in the middle. And that's the community experience. Yeah. It's not what you wanted. It's not totally awful either. When you're in this community experience, equanimity is a great way, it's a great place to establish the mind because we get to see the near enemy of equanimity, which is apathy, not caring. Now, if ever we feel an inclination to be like, "Oh, they're just going to do it that way. Well, there's nothing to be done about it. It's going to screw up. It's going to be a disaster. I don't want to watch. I'm just going to walk away." That is not equanimity, right? That is a things happen by the causes and conditions, but I don't want anything to do with it. It is a subtler form of aversion. Yeah. An important way to think about equanimity, and this might be something I've never said or something you've never heard is to actually remember and reflect that equanimity includes joy. The Brahma Viharas are joyful, energized states. We tend to, just as a definition of equanimity, think of it as a sort of vanilla, dry, simple, sterile kind of mind state, yeah? Oh, you can't get to me because I don't care. I'm good. You do you. I'll be fine. And that's not equanimity because that's not joyful. That's a sort of like everything's burning down, every person for themselves. And that's not equanimity because equanimity is a sense of the mind meets the object, right? The mind pervades a space such that it encounters every object without fear, without revulsion, right? So what would be this subtly joyous, energized relationship? Well, that would be, okay, this is the way we're doing things. Even when it's not the way we would have chosen, right? But this sort of, okay, this sort of acceptance and this sort of going along with it, yeah? There's no recoiling of the mind. There's a sense of participation. And when we get there, this is a wonderful thing in community. And I've often said, and I will say it until the day I die, because this has been what has kept me going in communities that I've been in, is that the person with the most equanimity is ultimately in charge. And this is what you see in any group dynamic. Metta, karuna, mudita, these positive emotions often give direction to a group. Yeah, if somebody's coming with greed, hatred, or delusion, and they're picking what should be done, it won't work, and you know it won't work, and you just try to mitigate the disaster that is unfolding. You try to look after people and be sure that nobody gets hurt. Yeah, you don't run for the hills, but you're like, okay, well, this is going to go bad, so I'm gonna make sure there's some pads laid out. I'm gonna make sure the circuit breaker's turned off so nobody gets electrocuted. I'm gonna be here for whatever unfolds. But there's times when, even though it's not the way you would choose to do something, you recognize the intention is wholesome. This person has a good idea and they're committed to it. Or this person really cares about the results and they want to do a good job. And so seeing that, you relinquish this sense of being in charge to that person, because the other Brahma Viharas, the other intentions that might go along with that, they take precedence. They have the momentum, so they get to decide. And the person with equanimity comes along for the ride, right? And this is this wonderful sense of, well, it's going to be okay, because everything happens by cause and effect. Yeah. And that's a wonderful state of mind to be in. And it's a wonderful, also when you see it in action, you get to see how powerful it is for a community and for a group of people when there is somebody in the group who has this sense of equanimity, that they're not avoiding the situation, nor are they wholly dictating the situation or deciding which way it'll go, but rather they are pervading the situation with their attention. And I can offer no other evidence, stronger evidence, that this is profoundly practical than how few serious injuries there are in monasteries. And Linda can back me up here. Like, things get set on fire. Like, things break down. Like, money gets spent in all sorts of ways. You know, whoever's in charge is not necessarily going to do things the most economical way, right? They might have an idea, but it might be like an expensive idea. There are so many things that go wrong or go sideways in all the various projects that get undertaken in a community. And yet, at the end of the day, everybody survives. And more than that, which is sometimes that's good enough, right? Good, nobody lost a finger. But other times, you can shoot for more, and you could say, not only did nobody get hurt, but lessons got learned. We did this as a group. Somehow, through some mysterious force, even though it seemed like a bad idea, it worked out in the end. And that's what you can say about all monasteries, because it's not a great idea to start up a place that's funded by generosity and is staffed completely by volunteers and is inhabited by homeless people and is devoted to sitting around paying attention to your breath. This is the worst idea for an institution that you could ever possibly have, and yet it has worked for thousands of years, right? How? Well, metta, karuna, mudita, yes, definitely, but also to a large degree, upekkha, equanimity. There were people who were willing to go to that space and pervade that space and be in that space no matter what would go on, no matter what was happening. And they would say, wow, the causes and conditions that lead to my practice. The good practice I know is developing the Eightfold Path for me, they are here. And there's a bunch of other things that I wouldn't choose if I could choose. But also, the wonderful thing about equanimity is it has this wisdom with it that says, you know, when I get to choose, I don't make the best choices. Sometimes, not getting to choose is perfectly fine because it still works out in the end. And furthermore, I didn't go in the direction of my defilements. Equanimity is a wonderful place to be in where we don't have to worry about our defilements because we're not making active decisions. We're not choosing the direction that things will go. Rather, we are looking at the way that things are going. And we are able to just see how things play out because we are not making the kamma, we are not making the decisions. We get to see the result of kamma, the result of decisions. They decided to do it this way based on what seemed to be this intention, and they got this result. Isn't that interesting? Oh, they did it this way with this intention, and they got that result. Oh, isn't that interesting? It's a wonderful place for really seeing kamma and its result. It's a great place for developing our wisdom. It's a great place for developing our practice. And, you know, I just want to make sure, looking at these worldly winds, something that also came up in our various talks over the last few weeks is anxiety and responsibility. You know, these are ideas that are sort of, you know, fear and a sense of responsibility. These are conventional ideas, as we've kind of explored. They definitely exist, and they definitely have a huge impact on us. But there are voices in our culture that say that these things are always there. You know, if you have a family, you have a responsibility to your family. If you have a job, you have a responsibility to your job. If you're a member of a particular country, you're a citizen, you have a particular responsibility to that country. Yeah. It provides you with services, so therefore you have a responsibility to it. These ideas, I mean, they're okay in a conventional sense, but we often find that in a Dhamma sense, they're too limited and constraining. And they have this idea that they always apply, which in terms of the Dhamma, we know that doesn't work. You know, there are things that are true and that tend to be true no matter what perspective you look at them. But when you look at something like fear, like this is dangerous, or you look at something like responsibility, like I am supposed to do this, this is my responsibility, you find that that's not always true. And anything that is true sometimes and not true other times, or that is conditionally true, like dogs are dangerous. Well, except when they're not, when they're fuzzy and they're rolling over and showing you their belly, you realize that the fear is not well founded. Yeah. You would say it's your responsibility to fulfill this contract until you realize the company on the other end of the contract did it in bad faith, and they've kind of worked you into this agreement that they benefit from and you lose all your money to. In that sense, you'd be like, well, you wouldn't ever counsel somebody to stick with that contract, right? You'd say, no, cancel the contract, get out of that. That's silly. You're wasting your money. In the same way, we can see certain conventional things in the world are part of these worldly winds, yeah? They make sense when we're trying to figure out, like, should we pay taxes or not? We look at it and we're like, well, there'll be consequences if I don't. But in terms of the Dhamma, we can also get to a place where we look at that not from a sense of responsibility or a sense of fear, like, oh, if I don't pay the taxes, the government's going to come and, take my stuff. But we look at it from a sense of, well, this is this. If I do it this, I'll get this result. So I should do it this way. If I were to do that, I would get that result, and I don't want that result. Equanimity is a place where we can still function. We can still make decisions. Yeah. But we don't get caught in the same net of anxiety and worry and guilt over the results. Yeah. When we make a decision that is grounded in equanimity, because equanimity pervades a space and a situation, it sees the good and the bad kind of equally. And when we do that, when we've developed that in our practice, what we get is we accept the results of whatever decision we make, right? So if we do have to make an important decision in our practice, developing the abiding of equanimity beforehand might help us not necessarily make the right decision, because that's going to be dependent on a lot of things, our intelligence, our understanding of the situation, the amount of information we have. But it will help us a lot afterwards relating to the results. I think of the idea of buyer's remorse. Yeah. You want something, you think you need something, you do the research, and then you buy it. And the second you have bought it, you're like, oh no, was that the right decision? Did I get the wrong thing? Did I pay too much? And that is going to be there. That is going to be there with so many things that we do in the world. Even becoming a monastic and moving into a monastery at a Dhamma level, you're like, yes, this will be a fantastic opportunity to practice. But then as soon as we get to the monastery, they're like, oh, they chant that way? Ah, that's not the way I was taught. Oh, they eat that? I don't even know what that is. Or they're putting me in that cabin? Why? That other one over there has plumbing. Why would they do that? Why? Why wouldn't they put me in the one with the plumbing? Yeah, you get to look at all of these things and say, what are the best conditions for my practice? Well, from what I can tell, they seem to be here. And I made this decision from a place of equanimity, just seeing all of the information I had and balancing it and saying, well, I'm going to get the results of this. And to sort of wrap things up, we don't always do the right thing. We don't always have the right answer. And equanimity is, as we cultivate it, and hopefully I've given some ideas for how you might cultivate it. If nothing else, you can have this idea of, well, I am the owner of my actions. All beings are the owners of their actions. Whatever we do, for good or for ill, we get the results. You say that, and then you say it, you don't say it when you're faced with a big problem, you're faced with that person, there's a project going on, and you're like, oh, I really don't want to do it, so I'm going to practice equanimity right now. No, you practice equanimity to get ready for that situation, right? It's much harder to do it when you're face to face with something that you disagree with. But if you develop equanimity, you get in a situation like, okay, we're doing it this way. Sometimes things don't go right, or sometimes you realize you didn't make the right decision. But because equanimity was there, it was set up in the mind, you get a sense of, well, all right. It's still everything is good because everything is going as it should. The conditions were put in and the result came about. And my favorite example of this is a monk I ordained with way back when. And after many years of practice, we both developed in slightly different directions. But I think because of the time that we showed up and the sort of fluctuations in the community, both of us as young monastics got to develop a lot of equanimity. It was a very turbulent time. And for me, it was a sense of just doing my own thing. And for this monk, it was a sense of giving everything to a project and just accepting whatever came about. You know, if we're going to meditate until 3 a.m., then he would meditate to 3 a.m. If we're going to move a log pile, then he'd move the log pile, everything with super enthusiasm. And one day we met each other. I was coming up the hill because I had just been doing my own thing and wandering around and helping people with projects, but not getting super involved. And he had been super involved in a big, like, painting renovation project. It had to get done, and he had the energy, so we helped do it. And we met halfway, both of us having developed equanimity in our own way, in our own practice. And I look at him, and he's coughing, and I'm like, "Are you all right?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you know, there was a lot of insulation in this place that we were just renovating, and I didn't wear a mask, and now it seems to be all in my lungs." And oh well. I only have myself to blame. And he said it with such joy, with such gleeful abandon, as he passed me and he went down the hill. And I'm like, that's amazing. And most people would probably say that's amazingly stupid. But my perspective at the time and ever since has been that was a profound Dhamma teaching, right? We don't always make the best decisions, but if we have developed some equanimity, we get to look at it as I'm going to learn from this. Yeah. And now this is present in the other three Brahmaviharas as well, but I think it's the strongest with the sense of equanimity. And importantly, with an equanimity developed properly, yeah, with energy, with joy, and with a sense of participation and pervading a space. Being willing to have any object that we relate to have the same emotional tone. This belongs, this belongs, this belongs, this belongs. Things are as they should be. Things are as they should be. Things are good. Things are good. Can we get there? Can we abide in it? And if we can, yes, you know, just saying, we might pass away from this mortal coil and end up in a state where, like the Brahma gods, we're in a mind-made state, and this is our de default experience. Things are good. Yeah. And unlike in the body, where sometimes things are good and sometimes things are not good, we'd be in a mind-made existence where nothing can touch us, nothing can hurt us, nothing can get to us. And through that whole existence, it would just be things are good. Things are as they should be. This is all right. So, with that thought, I offer this reflection this evening. I hope it's of some use in your practice. And I encourage you to, as long as this is still rattling around in your brain, go and sit and think about equanimity and see if you get any ideas or insights about it.